Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we speak with John Rubinstein. He's our guest for the full hour. We talk about his career and some great stories. So please stay tuned.
Everything has its season. Everything has its time. Show me a reason and I'll soon show you a rhyme. Cats fit on the windowsill. Children fit in the snow. Why do I feel I don't fit in anywhere I go? Rivers belong where they can ramble. Eagles belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run free. Gotta find my corner.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, April 22nd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening we have Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places on the internet. Also joining us is a special guest. Pinch hitting for Peter Felicia is John Rubinstein. John, thank you for coming to visit us on such short notice.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I listen to your show every week. I look forward to it. Sometimes you come on a day late or something, and I'm frustrated. I get all my big Broadway information from you, and being out in L.A., it's just wonderful to hear the news, the intelligent analysis, and the sort of gossip and stuff. It's all great.
You're too kind. I know that when we do get... when we do record on a Monday night, as we're doing tonight, come Monday morning when there's no new show, I start getting emails and phone calls from...
I don't want to bug you, but I would be one of those.
So
this worked out really well because Peter was unable to join us on kind of short notice, and James said, let's see if we can think of a special guest, and I thought of John... I mainly thought of John because Pippin is going to be opening quite soon, and we had mentioned a while back that we would like to have John on, to coincide with that. But now it also turns out that John has a concert coming up in New York. So why don't you tell us about that first, John?
Oh, yes. This is really a sort of an amazing piece. There's a wonderful conductor named Murray Sidlin. I've worked with him twice at the Aspen Music Festival in some years past. Once in a Stalin and Shostakovich concert where Michael York played Stalin and I played Shostakovich, and Murray conducts the big orchestra and plays lots of Shostakovich symphonies, and then we did a Tchaikovsky program also. And this one is called a Defiant Requiem. It's Verdi at Theresienstadt, the concentration camp where it seems a chorus of inmates got together in that camp in all those horrendous circumstances and performed, learned and performed with a smuggled score. They had one copy of it and they passed it around. The entire huge Verdi Requiem, which is a tremendous piece full of emotion and they performed it at the concentration camp. The SS, the people who were guarding them, made them do it for them. I know they performed it also for the Red Cross when they came. And a few of those people survived. And Murray Sidlin has put together a concert where they will perform the entire Verdi Requiem, but actors will read the testimony of some of those surviving chorus members who were able to tell that story before they died. So I know B.B. Newworth is among the other actors. I know I have to rehearse with her on Friday. And I don't know who else is in it. I'm a little bit ignorant about that, but I bet you could find out.
Well, that sounds extraordinary. It sounds a little bit like Playing for Time, that incredible TV.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. It made me think of that immediately.
I want to point out...
That's Monday night, April 29th at Avery Fisher Hall.
It's a benefit for UGA, and it's really wow! It's very very amazing.
I'm so excited to be a part of it. I just want to hear it, much less participate. So I feel very lucky that they asked me to do it.
Well, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, John's father was the great, great concert pianist Artur Rubinstein. So I'm sure, John, that you're kind of familiar with these classical types. I'm sure
it is. You know, that connection, I imagine, although I wish it had helped me more in my career, but it didn't. But it certainly plugged me into the classical music world. So as an actor, I frequently get asked to do stuff that involves classical music. I did a great thing with Lauren Mazel at Carnegie Hall a while back about Richard Strauss's Elektra with Colleen Dewhurst. And I've done a lot of The Soldier's Tale by Stravinsky. There's a wonderful composer named Mark Nykrug who wrote a piece called Through Roses, and another one that I do. Anyway, I do classical music that where actors are required, and it's great, great fun.
Have you done Peter and the Wolf?
Yeah, I'm doing it, as a matter of fact, right now. My son, one of my many children, is a trumpet player. He's 16, and he's in a high school orchestra that works out of the California University at Northridge, and a big symphony orchestra, a wonderful one. And they are doing Peter and the Wolf, and their conductor asked me to do it, so I get to perform it with my own kid playing the trumpet in the orchestra. So
that's great.
Wait, that's in 2 weeks.
Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, it's so much fun.
So let's talk about some of your Broadway shows that you've done. I just wanted, for the listeners, go down a list of them. Of course, we start with Pippin. You also were in Children of a Lesser God, Fools, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, Hurly Burly, M. Butterfly, Love Letters, Getting Away with Murder, and Ragtime. So tell us, not in any particular order, what are some of your favorite stories from your experiences there?
Oh, my God. I mean, you could set me off. I could talk for 2 hours. Get emails about...
So we don't talk very much about Hurly Burly. Why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, Hurly Burly. That was both one of the great joys and the great sadnesses of my career. I was doing a television series. I got a job on a pilot of a show called Crazy Like a Fox with Jack Warden playing this crazy San Francisco detective, and I was his very uptight lawyer son. And, you know, the routine was that he would get into these crazy detective things and involve me terribly reluctantly, and I would end up, you know, I fell into the San Francisco Bay. I had to get in drag and ride bicycles down the steps of, you know, we got into crazy car chases. It was a really very good show and great fun. But anyway, we shot 6 of them. And that was it. And, you know, then it was going to go on the air and nobody knew anything. Meanwhile, Mike Nichols asked me to take over for William Hurt in Hurly Burly on Broadway. There was a bunch of cast changes going on. Susan Anton came in with me, Christine Baranski. She took over for Judy Ivey. And Kevin Spacey actually was an understudy.
Wow.
And I did the show with him a few times.
No.
And I loved that part. It was just a great role, just so interesting. And I loved working with Mike. It was the third time that I'd worked with Mike. And I, you know, as almost every actor who's ever worked with Mike Nichols will say, he's just one of the greatest directors. You just can't wait to work with him. Every rehearsal, everything is just an education and a joy. He's one of the kind of directors who laughs out in rehearsals. And if you make Mike Nichols laugh, you know, it makes his day. So anyway, he directed this scene, one of the first scenes in that play, the two casting directors. We're talking about other matters, but the direction was, we're going through these piles of 8x10s of these gorgeous girls, and we're looking at them and tossing them into waste paper baskets. Dozens of them, just while we're talking about other things. Just a great piece of business that I never would have thought of myself. I just loved doing that.
Tell me about...
Anyway, so I loved doing that show. And then the night I opened, I got a phone call from my agent in L.A. saying, hey, they want 7 more episodes because they're going with 13 on the initial run of the show, of the series with Jack Warner.
Oh. So,
although I was, you know, happy that it was successful and they liked it, they owned me. I had to go to the producers and Mike and say, I got to go.
Oh.
I got to do the show. So what happened was, I did the show in New York for, I think, something like 4 weeks, and then I started shooting episodes of the show out here at Warner Brothers, and I would work Monday through Friday. On Friday night, I would take the red eye at 10:30 out of LAX, get to New York at 6, 7 in the morning. I was doing a radio show about Carnegie Hall then, so I'd run to Carnegie Hall and record 2 or 3 radio shows, then go to the Barrymore, do the matinee in the evening of Hurley Burley on Saturday, and do the Sunday matinee, and then run to the airport, make the late night flight to L.A., and be on the set at Warner Brothers at 6 in the morning on Monday morning. I did that for a bunch of weeks. So I would do 3 shows, and John Christopher Jones, who was my understudy, played the part on the weekdays. But that was a tragedy, and then, you know, because I love doing 8 shows a week. To me, that's the best living condition is when you're doing 8 shows a week of something.
I'm reading here in IMDb that Cynthia Nixon was in the cast, and she was in 2 shows at the same time.
She was in 2 shows at the same time.
She was in The Real Thing and Hurley Burley at the same time.
Yeah.
And
she was in the first and last scenes of Hurley Burley, and she was in the middle scenes of The Real Thing, so she ran from theater to theater every night.
And in The Real Thing also had Glenn Close, Jeremy Irons, Christine Baranski. I guess she... left one show and went to the other show. Peter Gallagher. Wow.
That was crazy.
That is crazy. You can't make this stuff up.
And the thing I loved about Hurley Burley, among many others, was since I was exhausted when I finally showed up and started to do the show, which lasted, you know, 3 hours and 45 minutes. It was really long. The very first scene in it, I'm stoned and hungover and out of my mind, and the other character comes on stage and makes me coffee, goes into this kitchen, and he has most of the lines because I'm too stultified to talk, and he goes into this onstage kitchen and makes real coffee and brings it to me in my big chair where I'm sitting, and I get to start the show sort of comatose and with a nice hot cup of coffee. There was no better way to start a show.
Well, you know, another show that I'm thinking you might have very mixed feelings about also is Getting Away with Murder.
Oh, dear.
Which I saw. That. I mean, how incredible is this? Written by Stephen Sondheim and George Firth.
This is a
non-musical. Directed by Jack O'Brien, which I didn't remember.
Yeah, we did at the Old Globe to begin with.
Yeah.
And Terry Mann was in that.
And Christine Ebersole.
And Christine Ebersole, who was amazing. And it was a wonderful cast. Josh Mostel was in it. Wonderful people. And my best story out of that is really one that you'd think somebody's making up. At the end of the first act, there it was a murder mystery, you know, which Sondheim loves to write. And he and George, you know, conceived it together. I think Stephen made up the story and the plot, and then George wrote the jokes and the dialogue. And they sort of worked together like that. It was great fun, and we had a riot doing it in San Diego. And then when it came to Broadway, there were some cast changes and stuff. And at the end of the first act, I play this guy who kills everybody else in the cast. We're all sitting in this psychiatrist's office, and I kill 7 people. Chuck Cooper came at me, and he's gonna wipe me out. So I pull a gun and I shoot him. He goes down. Then Terry Mann. No, it was Frankie Faison. It was Frankie Faison. Chuck Cooper did it at the Globe, and it was Frankie who did it on Broadway. I shoot Frankie, and then Terry Mann comes at me, and I shoot him. And then there's three people sitting on the couch, and I go, bang, 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 they die. Christine Ebersole is trying to get out the door. Bang, I shoot her. Josh Mostel runs into the psychiatrist's inner room, and I pursue him in there, and I bang, I shoot him. And then I have some funny line and curtain, and that's the end of Act One. And, of course, one night my gun didn't work. And here's, you know, Frankie Faison is three times my size. And so I sort of fake hit him. I go, pow! And he goes, ugh, and he dies. And here comes Terry Mann. And I sort of give him a backhand on the face. Bang! Ah, he falls, and he's dead. Three people on the couch. I climb over the stupid coffee table. I strangle them. I elbow them in the chest. I kick one of them. They die. Christine Ebersole, who could have gotten out of the door 10 minutes ago, is standing by the door, being a good sport, going, oh, 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 screaming, waiting for me. I go over to her, and I sort of pound her on the head, and she goes down and dies. And now Josh Mostel, of course, wouldn't play ball. He runs into the other room, and I sort of hit him or do something, and he doesn't die. And so he makes me really have to go through this horrendous thing. All the corpses are lying, of course, laughing. They're all heaving with laughter. And he finally dies, and I spit out that line, and the curtain comes down. I'll never forget that. That was on Broadway. I mean, that wasn't even a preview.
Well, it was billed as a comedy thriller, so that night especially.
And then the stage manager came to me and said, John, I was standing in the wings with a gun. Oh, I could have done all the sound effects, but we had never discussed that.
I was just going to say that I would love to read the stage manager report for that night.
Yeah, he was ready, but we had never discussed it, so I didn't know. Oh, my God.
Tell me about Love Letters. Who did you... there's a massive list of women that did this, but I don't know who you played against.
I did it originally. The very first production of it was at Long Wharf, and I did it there with... Joanna Gleason.
Oh.
We were the very first to do it.
Wow, that's
and
amazing.
I had no idea. We rehearsed it in my house. Joey Tillinger, John Tillinger came over, and we sort of read through it very cursorily. I mean, I have to say, we all three were, I don't know if we were arrogant or if we just had such confidence in Pete Gurney's work. Both, I think. So we read through it, and we said, oh yeah, this works. This is fun. This is great. We went up to New Haven. We had a quick tech. You know the show. You just come in, you sit down, you read, and you leave. So we teched it, the lights, turned the pages. Yeah, we talked about it briefly. And fine, and that night was opening night. There was no, you know, preview or anything. And we showed up, we sat down, we started to read this thing. And suddenly, this sort of, it's a masterpiece. I don't throw that word around. It is a masterpiece of writing. And it works with actors of all different types and ages. But we had never heard it before. And it's so moving at the end. I could barely get the lines out. Generally, if you have a role that's going to cost you some big emotion, you know that's coming. You've rehearsed it through. You know how to guide your way through it. I was unprepared, and I really... sort of stumbled across the finish line of that play, almost unable to speak. I was so moved. And then we did its New York premiere. It was me and Kathleen Turner. We did it at the Promenade on 77th
Broadway.
Street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was the very first, and that was a one-time event. I can't remember if it was a benefit or something, but it was just what it was. Then they opened it officially off-Broadway New York premiere at that same theater. And then it was Joanna Gleason and me again. And then they had they had other actors. I know that Jason Robards did it with Strich?
Yeah.
With Strich, yeah, and other combinations. And then it opened on Broadway. But I didn't open it. I was mad about that. Jason and Colleen opened it. Huh. Fancy that. But then the next week, it was me and Stockard Channing. And so then I did it a lot around the country with Stockard. I did it with all kinds of people, with Blythe Danner, with Ali McGraw, with, oh, gosh, a whole host of women. All wonderful, all different. With Meredith Baxter, who had played my wife for 5 years on Family, this old TV series.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did it together in San Francisco. Yeah, it was fun. Great, great show. I can't wait to do it again.
Huh. That's...
What a brilliant piece of writing.
Yeah.
So tell us, we're dancing around Pippin, with Pippin with Pippin Pippin coming up very soon.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Did you expect it to be so long between the original Broadway production and now? What do you attribute that length of time to?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I could theorize. You know, Pippin, when it opened, when we opened it back, it's 40 years ago. 40 and a half years ago. We opened it, 72 October. It didn't get very good reviews. It wasn't embraced. They thought it was superficial. They weren't terribly bowled over by the music or the book. Nor by me, I would have to add. They loved Ben Vereen. They loved Irene Ryan. And they loved, of course, Bob Fosse, who was so brilliant in taking what is essentially a very, very light piece and making it, giving it some real weight and complication, as well as razzle-dazzle. I mean, if there was any show that was dazzling, I didn't miss a show for, I don't know, 10, 11 months, but finally I got a whooping cough of some kind. Could not perform. But I was healthy enough, so I went to the back of the theater and I watched Walter Willison, who was my understudy, go on in my part. And I just almost fainted from how gorgeous that show was. Tony Walton's sets and Pat Ziprot's costumes and Jules Fisher's lighting. It was a stunning thing to watch. And even, you know, when you do a show like that, you're standing in the middle of it. You see all the nuts and bolts, and you're desperately trying to hit your high notes and get through it in your bare feet and not fall. And when you stand back and watch it, I was knocked over. So the show was so gorgeous that it became a hit. And also, we improved it. It got better and better and better as we did it. We worked very hard on it, all of us in it. And Reinking was in the chorus of it, and other great people. Irene was amazing. Joe Clayburgh was amazing as Catherine. And Eric Berry played the King. And Leland Palmer played the, in quotes, Glenn Verdon role, the Fastrada. Chris Chadman was my brother.
Yes.
It was a wonderful cast, and the dancers were, every one of them were the sort of the cream of the crop of Broadway at that time. And we improved it, and so that people who saw it 8 months, a year later said, it's a different show. It's so much better.
Now, the legend is that the famous TV commercial really, really helped the box office. Is that how you remember it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't know if it was Stu Ostro or Bob or both of them. They said, let's do a TV commercial. And they did one where they didn't do what they do now. All shows show montages. They show this moment and that moment and cut, 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 edit, edit, edit. And they sort of try to show you the whole show. And Bob just took the little part called, it was called in our day, the Manson Trio. I don't know if it's still.
Apparently, yes. Yeah.
And it was Ben Vereen and Pamela Sousa and Candy Brown, and him and them in the back with canes and straw hats. I don't think they were bowlers, but I may be crazy.
No, I think you're right. Straw. That sounds
and
right.
And doing their little yump, patep, 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 a little step, very subtle, Fosse step. And then the announcer came on and said, "You've just seen 60 seconds of Pippin. If you want to see the whole show, come to the Imperial Theater.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and they played it all around the country, so people saw it in Dubuque and came to New York burning to see Pippin. And it really did make it a hit, and it ran for 5 years.
And so with this coming back 40 years later, it seems like such a timeless story that I haven't seen this production yet. But
it is. It's every man versus the devil. It's Faust. It's Candide.
Mm.
And it's its own thing. It's a young, innocent, very ambitious, very self-involved young callow fellow who happens to be the son of the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So he has choices, and he makes them all. He's frustrated and disappointed at every one of them, and then it turns into this other whole thing where he's been the dupe, sort of like, of the witches of Macbeth. He becomes this character who has been led down this pathway mm-hmm. by his darker self, or by the devil, or however you want to make the leading player be characterized. And he's offered, you can go out. Sure, life is worthless, everything's horrible, but you could go out by just killing yourself in front of everybody, and it'll be remembered, and it'll be glorious, and he almost does it, and finally he decides, no, I won't play this game. And the devil is frustrated and tears down the scenery and leaves him alone with this young widow that he's sort of fallen in love with and her young boy. And he says, okay, I'm going to stay here and just live a life. And maybe this is as big as it needs to get because there's a heart in it. To me, that was always very moving, and I think that is the kernel of what has made Pippin last so long.
Well, not to put you on the spot, and of course, Stephen Schwartz himself has spoken about it. There was famously a tremendous amount of tension, apparently, between he and Fosse, different visions of the show. But yeah. I always think, and Stephen, you know, and now looks back on it and kind of, I think he, I pretty much says that he thinks it really was all for the best, to use one of his titles of his songs from another show, because it's one of those things where you have a person, Fosse, who I guess it's fair to say basically has a kind of a cynical, very show busy, flashy style that he's most famous for. Compared to Schwartz's style, which is more open-hearted, maybe more sentimental, some might say. But but the very fact that there was this tension between them maybe resulted in a show that was really much more engaging because of that.
I think you got it exactly right. And even back then at the time, I was 25 years old, and it was my very first Broadway play, so I was sort of in a big role, but you know, a newcomer, didn't have any like clout. But of course, Bob Fosse was one of those people who, in spite of his huge, you know, reputation and everything else, experience, he would listen to people. He would listen to me, among others, and he listened to Stephen too. And Stephen was, as you say, his approach to it was a little sentimental, very young, you could accuse it of being just a little bit ornate here and there. And Bob sort of cut that out and down and made it into what we were talking about before, the sort of Faustian, those dancers in their sort of, you know, Commedia dell'arte get-up were devil's minions. They were luring the audience into, come on, come up stage, let us do this for you, you can be the next one. And they were sexy and sinuous and sinister. And they hadn't been quite that way in Stephen's original conception. The leading player was sort of like the guy in Hamlet, you know. He was an old, ho-ho, British kind of, ho-ho, older actor guy.
Okay.
And Fosse said, nah, let's make it be Ben Vereen. And that completely changed it.
Oh, that's interesting. With. Yeah.
And so then, and Bob worked very hard at cutting through the sentimentality. Mm. Now, I, you know, loved Bob for doing that, but I also felt with Stephen that he went a little bit too far here and there. He cut so much of the sentiment out of it that I think that was one of the many reasons that the critics were cold to it at first. There was a moment at the very end, I harp on this, I've said this before, very, very end of the play, and we're standing there, the three of us, Catherine and me and the little boy on the other side, and she asks me a couple of questions. Do you feel this? No. Do you feel that? No. And she finally says, well, how do you feel? And I say, I think for a minute, and I say, trapped. Audience howls with laughter because it's cynical, it's funny, it's what we all feel. We're trapped in our lives. We wanted to be this, we hoped we would get that, but no, we're doing what we're doing, and we're trapped in it. So it's a cynical, funny Broadway laugh. And then I wait for that laugh to die, which was always huge. And then I would say, but happy. And then the audience would go, oh, yes, thank you, yes. Because even though I don't have everything I've always dreamed of, I'm happy, I love my life, I love my whatever, my job, my kids, my wife, I love my dog, I'm happy.
And say the next line,
please. That was a huge relief and joy. And then I would raise their little hands and the three of us would be there in the work light. And I say, which isn't too bad for the end of a musical comedy. Ta-da! And the curtain would fall. And we did that in Washington, D.C. at the Opera House in our out of town. Audiences loved it, and it got rave reviews in Washington, D.C. We came to New York. We made many improvements, many changes. Bob worked very hard on all the dance numbers. And he, I think the night before we opened, he cut out those two words, but happy. I said, oh, my God, don't do that, because that will kill the sense, the feeling of relief, of hope at the end. He said, nah, John, you're a sentimentalist. You know, forget it. You know, I don't want people calling me that. So, nope. And we cut it out, and there it was, and I say, trapped. Audience screams with laughter, as always. And then I wait till that's over, and I pick their hands up, and I say, which isn't too bad for the end of a musical comedy.
That doesn't even make any sense.
And the audience goes, ugh. And the curtain falls, and everybody trudges out, sad. And just those two little words, you know, the end of a play is where it rests. It's where it comes to rest. And we did it like that for 5 years, you know, and every night I missed it. On my closing night, I did it for 2 years and some. I was tempted to just break the rule and stick in but happy, but I didn't do it. I was a good boy. But in the published version, Stephen and Roger Herson put but happy back in, and it's been done that way ever since.
Yes.
Because they were right to do that. But now, he's changed the ending yet again.
Right.
Stephen has. And I did Wicked. Out here in California, I played the Wizard for a couple of years, and Stephen was here, and I said to him, why did you do that? Well, you've wrecked it. And he said, oh, John, you don't know what you're talking about. You're still a sentimentalist, you always were. No, my boy, it's much, much better now. It's what it always should have been. It's way more cynical than Fosse ever dreamed. And I haven't seen the one in New York, but if it's that, I'm going to be sad about it. Unless they convince me, which they might.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think it's the ending I've seen previously where at the very end, young Theo starts to sing Corner of the Sky. Isn't that
yes.
what happened? Yeah. Well, that's not necessarily.
As old Pippin as I am, you know, the old version of Pippin crawling around, how could Pippin and Catherine ever have allowed Theo to stay behind?
Mm.
They would come and get him. Yep. You know what I mean? I saw it like that in Seattle, Washington, and Pippin and Catherine blithely go off, and he comes back, little Theo, and he sings, I want to ramble, and the Eagles, and then the leading player and all the players come sneaking back on, and they envelop him, and they take him away.
Oh, I see.
I don't know if they do that in this production, but that's what they did there, and I think they had done it that way first at the paper mill or something like that.
Anyway. I think Stephen saw a production somewhere. It was pre-Paper Mill, I think. He saw it done somewhere like that, and he loved it. But I don't know if when I saw it, it wasn't so much that Theo was leaving them. It wasn't done that way. So I guess even within that new concept, there are different interpretations.
I loved the old version of But Happy, which I got to do only, whatever, for 4 weeks at the Kennedy Center, and that was it in September of 72, and then never got to do it again.
This is also interesting, John. I knew the cast album before I ever saw the show, because I never saw it on Broadway during the original run, I regret to say. And
yeah, I'm
always
a proud Motown recording artist.
Yes,
we were just talking about that, yeah.
Because, you know, Motown is on Broadway now, and I half jokingly said to Peter and James that I was waiting for a song from Pippin, you know. But anyway, one of my you know, I mean, I love the whole score, but one of my favorite songs is With You, which is so beautiful.
Oh, I love it, too.
And I was so upset when I finally saw it staged to see that it had been turned into a kind of a joke by Fosse, you know, where he goes from this one woman to the next.
Yeah, but it works so brilliantly like that. Didn't you feel?
I guess not. No, I didn't, because that's not how I pictured it.
Oh.
I mean, I thought it would be that he sang that song totally sincerely, you know, just and heartfelt to, as if he were singing to one woman, and then immediately after that, all of the sex stuff would start.
Oh, no, it was great. The great Jennifer Nairn Smith, who lives out here and is still a dear friend of mine, was this gorgeous ballerina from Balanchine, from the New York City Ballet. Mm. And Fosse put her in, and she's the first girl I sing to, and she has this beautiful, amazing long hair that came cascading down, and I'd sing, "Hi, da da dee da da dee da da," you know? And then With You, I would do this sort of double take, and there was another girl all the way across the stage, and suddenly I'm continuing the love song to her. And no, I thought that was great, because Pippin is singing it with all his heart. He's not being cynical about it, but he's doing what young men, what young boys tend to do. They just fall in love with the, if I'm not near the girl I love, you know, just the next one that passes by, oh my God, look at her, you know.
Oh, I guess.
It was very, very funny, and yet still was sort of truthful and had its sentiment in it. I thought that was great. Although it was hard hitting a high A flat with two girls sitting on my back as I was on all fours. That was not the most fun moment of my evening.
But you do it again in a heartbeat.
You bet I would.
Absolutely. Let me ask you just briefly, get off of Pippin for a second and talk about your experiences in ragtime. How did you find that role at Tate?
That was a combined sadness and great, great happiness for me. I was up for the movie of that. Miloš Forman directed it, and I think, one of the last couple of people considered, and I actually thought I was going to get it. And then, of course, Mandy Patinkin, who always gets my part, and who I love and I've worked with and is a friend. He got it, and it was great in it. So then years later, here comes the musical. I say, the musical of Ragtime. I could still play Tata. I'm actually older and old enough to do it. And so I auditioned, and they gave it to Peter Friedman. I was crushed. That's really one of the most crushed I've been. I've been in this business so long. I've auditioned for so many things. I've lost so many parts, as we all have. And I've always been relatively good about it. Whatever, okay, not that one, on to the next. But that one really was a javelin in my heart. Because they were all going to, the deal was you played Toronto for a full year, and then you were guaranteed you would open on Broadway. And I was ready to find a place to live in Toronto and bring my kids and just be there. No. So I, you know, went on with my life. And then suddenly, after they opened in Toronto, it was really soon after, a couple of months, I think, they said, we're going to make the first American production, not on Broadway, but in Los Angeles at the Schubert Theater. And I auditioned again, and this time I got the part. And so I actually did the American premiere at the Schubert. Judy Kaye was in our cast, and Stokes, you know, Brian Stokes Mitchell came out and opened with us. LaShance played
Sarah,
and was brilliant. That's one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen, was her in that show. John Dossett was father. Marcia Mitzman played the mother. And it was really the same show as they were doing in Toronto, exactly the same sets, the same costumes, everything the same. Graciela Danielle and, you know, they all came out here, and Frank Galati, and put it together, and we had a full rehearsal schedule. And I tell you, it was one of the great happinesses of my entire life to get to do that show. We spent the first week learning the music, which was huge, and a cast of 60 or something like that. And then at the end of that week, we all sat in chairs in the room, and we read through the whole play, all the dialogue scenes, which we hadn't rehearsed at all, and sang all the music around them. And it was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had, just musically, theatrically, sitting with all those amazing singers, singing those great harmonies, those huge numbers. I love that show. To me, Ragtime is the show that if I ruled the world, that would be the one that never closes in New York. Mm. It wouldn't be Phantom. It wouldn't be Cats. It wouldn't be whatever else it is, Les Mis. It would be Ragtime. That would be the thing that people would journey around the world to come to New York.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
It's a tragedy to me that that isn't the case. But there you have it. But I did it here in L.A. for a year. I did it in Vancouver for 3 or 4 months. And then I came to Broadway and took over for Peter and did it for another year there. And I relished every single performance that I got to do.
Did you feel that there was any parallels between your father and Tate?
No, not really. I mean, subliminally, my father lived in Europe when the war started. He lived in Paris. He was already sort of an international concert guy, you know, traveling the world.
Yeah.
He had refused to play in Germany since 1914. He had been educated in Berlin. He left his Polish family, and I mean, they sent him to Berlin to study with the great Joachim, who was a student of Brahms, when he was 10, and he lived alone in Berlin as a 10-year-old boy. And so Germany and Berlin and the artistic community that were his real, you know, background. But after 1914, you know, he said, nope, the anti-Semitism and the whole thing just was more than he would take. So, and he never played in Germany again his whole life. But in 1939, they lived in Paris, and they realized what was about to happen, and they just moved to New York, became American citizens, and with their my older brother and sister, who were little kids then, and then they moved out here to California, and that's where I was born later in the late 40s.
So, John, before we wrap up, we've talked about so much of your stage experience, and we touched upon a little bit of your television, but you just have such a deep resume in film and television as well that we haven't really mentioned. You want to tell us any fun stories that that we don't generally hear about?
Gosh, fun stories.
Well, I mean, working family certainly is a
that was a great experience, putting that together, and with Aaron Spelling and Mike Nichols and
Seda Thompson
and Jimmy Broderick, who, you know, is of course Matthew's dad.
Yes,
played the father on that, and wonderful people. And we rehearsed every show. There was a sort of a New York theater kind of, you know, attitude about it. They wrote beautiful scripts, and it was one of the first shows that actually started the trend, which is now ubiquitous, of that every weekly show is a continuing story. That didn't used to be the case. Yeah. You would have your very popular shows, whatever they were, comedies or dramas, and they would have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the same leads every time, and the crime would be solved, or the little family, you know, problem would be resolved. But only the soaps continued from episode to episode during the day. And on this show, they started doing that. That started a big trend, and which is now every single show has that, pretty much. I don't know about funny stories.
well, we shouldn't.
Great things, but nothing that jumps to mind as something hysterically funny.
We should probably just touch at least briefly on your Tony Award-winning performance in Children of a Lesser God.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention, Tony Drama Desk, Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle, and Drama Log Awards. The thing I remember, it was such a wonderful show with Phyllis Frelick. Is that how you say it?
Frelick, yeah.
But also I remember, I have a clear memory of your Tony Award acceptance speech, if I recall, you thanked... I seem to remember you thanked someone who helped you get through Pippin vocally. Is that right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Keith Davis.
Yeah, okay.
Keith Davis was at that time the sort of number one vocal coach to the Broadway singers. I would run into Larry Kurt there. I would run into Robert Morse there. Everybody who was working on Broadway seemed to go running in and out of Keith's room, and he showed me how to use, you know, I've never been a great singer, and I still am not. And this was the first time that I'd done 8 shows a week for that long, singing that much.
Mm.
And after, you know, the first few weeks of rehearsals, I was, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And he saved me. He showed me how to do it. I was very grateful to him.
Well, I just thought there was something so sincere and so touching about you thanking him in your acceptance speech for another show years later. It just showed how important that was to you.
Absolutely.
That he helped you with that.
Yeah, I tried to thank not only the people who had done Children of a Lesser God, of course, whom I loved and was so grateful to for that part, but the people from way back who were the first people to give me a job out here in California at Melodyland with Howard Keel playing the little boy who runs on at the end of Camelot. That was my first professional job.
Oh.
And those people gave me the part. They didn't have to. That started my career. I've been working ever since. And Bob Fosse, good grief, you know, who put me in the title role of a big musical on Broadway when I had never put my foot on a Broadway stage before. People like that, and Keith, who taught me, and the people that I regret still to this day that I did not thank that night, the ones that I forgot, were Garson Kanin and Ruth Gordon,
oh,
who were my parents' friends, but they were the type of parents' friends who took the children seriously. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
sure, yeah.
You know, lots of people, and you meet your parents' friends, and they say, oh, you know, what grade are you in, and all that kind of stuff, and oh, isn't he cute, or isn't he not cute? But Garson would sit down and, well, Johnny, tell me what's going on in your life. When I was, 7, 8, when I played Macbeth in 8th grade at my little grade school there in New York.
Oh, my goodness.
He came and saw me do that. And he said, you're going to be an actor. I was 13, barely 13. You're going to be an actor, Johnny. And he would invite me to every rehearsal. I saw him direct Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl rehearsals. Marvin Hamlisch was playing rehearsal piano.
Oh, my God.
And I saw him direct. I sat him, you know, every day. I saw him put together Do Re Mi. I saw him direct Sunday New York with young Robert Redford. You know, I was at the rehearsals. I saw him direct Ruth Gordon in all the stuff that she was in. Then when I was at UCLA, he came out here. They moved out here. And he brought me to the scoring stages when he would direct a movie. He had me read with all the beautiful babes that were going to be up for part in a movie he shot in Las Vegas. And I got to do the readings for them on the screen tests. And I learned how to score movies. He invited me to see Johnny Mandel conduct a score, and I started scoring movies after that. So he was my huge mentor, and Ruth, too, always. They let me live in their house in Turtle Bay right next door to Katharine Hepburn when I was doing Children of a Lesser God. And right around the corner from them lived Sondheim,
right,
whom I hadn't worked with yet. And one day I was sitting in Garson's and Ruth's living room playing the piano, which I, you know, do just to get me through life. And the doorbell rang, and I went downstairs to the front door. I opened it, and there's Stephen Sondheim. And he's saying, "Could you please stop playing the piano? I'm trying to write something, and all I can hear is your damn playing." I said, "Sure, I'm really, really sorry." he was writing speechless. Sunday in the Park with George, I guess.
I'm speechless. I don't know.
For Mandy, nonetheless. So I'm looking on IMDb, and it says... this might be accurate. You have 27, you scored 27 different film and television shows?
Oh, I scored way more than that. No.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
More close to 100 or something.
Wow.
So, the Renaissance man that you are.
Yeah, a lucky guy, got a lot of good sort of mentoring and teaching and experience when I was a young boy, and got to sort of put it all to work.
That's just goes to show you. I mean, those stories about your parents' friends taking you seriously, and it's about appreciating the children and teaching.
Yes,
and
what a gift that is. And I teach now. I teach at USC. I direct their musicals, and I teach how to audition for musicals and other acting stuff. And people who have benefited from this business. I wouldn't say owe it, but it's such a joy, and it's such a valuable thing to pass that on to the kids. Give them the tricks that they've learned and the deep sort of metaphysical stuff that they've learned how to cope with, and try to pass that on and try to inspire. That's really the word, to inspire and show concrete examples of things that they can do. I'm loving doing that.
Well, John, you continue to inspire many people all around the world, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's such an honor. I tell you, I just love your show again. I thank you for it, and Peter and all three of you. You do such a great job week after week.
Well, thank you. It is almost Tuesday morning, so we're going to let you run and get ready for your stuff, but... I think we're going to wrap up tonight. Michael and I will skip everything till next week. We'll talk about other openings and news next week. But John, you have filled our hour full of inspiration, and I want to thank you so much.
Oh, bless your heart. And let's say a little merd and good luck to the Pippin cast and crew and everybody there.
Absolutely. They have a big week coming up in front of them.
Yeah.
So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us another way, you can listen to us through Stitcher, which is an app for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry. And that way you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to your device without syncing. We also get played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Michael, for Peter, and for me are at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to various different things we talked about. So also wanted to remind everybody before we wrapped up is that coming up this week on PBS is the Lincoln Center. Was it Lincoln Center? Was the concert?
Well, it was at Avery Fisher. The New York Philharmonic with Nathan Gunn and Kelly O'Hara and Jesse Mueller. Yeah, Kelly O'Hara. And Jason Danieli and Stephanie Blythe. It was an absolutely amazing night, and I'm so glad it's going to be televised. I just wish I don't understand how some of these things are eventually released on DVD and some of them are not. I understand why, for example, South Pacific at Lincoln Center and those shows from Lincoln Center Theater, I assume it's because the equity contracts are, tend to prohibit those kinds of sales of DVDs without the actors making a certain deal. But I know that the ones that take place in concert halls sometimes are released. For example, The Company that was done with Neil Patrick Harris that Lonnie Price directed. So I don't know, but the fact that it was at Avery Fisher maybe will lead us to hope that at some point this might be released on DVD. But in case it's not, get your TiVos ready. Your DVRs, your TiVos, whatever you still use to tape or record from TV.
And hopefully, you know, PBS on their fundraising drives will find a reason to get that out to the public again and see it a few times.
Yeah.
It's playing this week on PBS in New York, and check your local listings because I know that sometimes it gets played in different parts of the month in different parts of the country. So I guess that's it for right now. We will see you next week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and John Rubenstein, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
If I could share my days with you, my nights are warmer than fire coals, incense and stars and smoke bamboo. But nights were warm beyond compare if I could share.